This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. We're back for our latest lockdown bonus episode, this time talking to James Downs. He's a campaigner and also advises the charity Mind on how to develop their campaigning and anti-stigma message. So we're really glad to have got to speak to him. In this episode, we're talking a lot more about politics and how that relates to the pandemic and, of course, our mental health. Please note this was recorded on the 4th of May, so some of the developments around lockdown being lifted hadn't yet taken effect or been announced. But it was really interesting to hear in depth his analysis of how the government have handled this, particularly around communication, the importance of having a clear understanding of how to stay safe and keep those around you safe can be really key if you're struggling with your mental health. He also touches on what steps he's taking to maintain his own mental health during this constantly changing time. And like many of the people we're talking to in the bonus episodes, James will be back to talk more at length once our life starts to get back to normal. For now, though, please enjoy this special episode.
Hi, my name's James and I'm 30 years old. I'm a mental health campaigner and I teach yoga and a bit of dance. And I try a little bit of academia every now and again. So all these things come together, sometimes a bit more messily than others, but I like to think they come together quite well in areas of well-being. Lockdown is really up and down, I think. There are definitely down moments of lockdown. And I think that I've really struggled with things around eating in particular. So most of my experiences of mental health problems have been with eating disorders, both anorexia and bulimia. And I'm not recovered, and I even find recovery a bit of a problematic word, but I certainly am better in some ways than I used to be. But lockdown completely changed everything, really, for everyone, didn't it? And being able to eat food outside was something that was really important to me. Eating on my own in my house, even though I'm in a shared house, is more challenging, and it lends itself a bit more to secrecy and eating in private and then being more at risk of binge eating, which is something that I really struggle with. Whereas a big part of recovery was learning to eat outside and learning to eat with other people and it being safe and it being positive. So that suddenly was taken away, you know, almost overnight, not being able to go to a cafe or whatever, which is actually a really safe space for me. So I've been finding that really, really hard and trying to work out how can I replace some of the positive elements of that, even though the practical stuff can't be the same. But actually, it does provide a few opportunities, I think. It makes me recognize that, okay, I do need support in some ways, like social support around eating, and that I have to kind of ask for it if I need it. And it's been a chance to practice all those skills of asking for help, even if you don't really feel like you want to all the time. And also finding new ways to exercise, because exercise is a way that I regulate emotions, and sometimes that can tip into being quite unhealthy. But having the gym not being open, I had to be quite creative about exercising in different ways, and then actually recognizing, you know, you can have a break if you need a break, and taking time to rest and not have to be on the go all of the time. I think that's been a bit of an opportunity too. So it definitely comes with ups and downs.
I'm really pleased to hear you're so tuned in to these factors in your mental health, particularly in a time when we're all just trying to figure this out. We don't really know what we're doing as much as we try or might try and put that across. It's good to hear that through your recovery, you've learned what so many of your triggers are and the things you need to focus on. And so you've still been able to hang on to that in lockdown.
Yeah, I would say that is one of the most important things, is to really try and tune into what you need right now. And so often we compare ourselves in society, don't we? And especially with social media. And I've definitely noticed a massive pressure at the moment for people to be exercising all the time at home, because fitness has had to turn into home fitness. And there's a wonderful array of exercises and workouts you can do if you have connection to the internet and a little bit of space, and most of it's free. And I think that a lot of people might struggle with that if they already feel quite pressurized in terms of body image and food and weight and shape and all those kinds of things. So I think that for me, that's been really important to listen to what do I need to do right now rather than do I need to keep up with all of these quarantine workouts, you know? I think that there is also pressure to be making the best use of this time, as though you suddenly got loads of time on your hands, which isn't the case for everybody. I mean, people with children suddenly have to be full-time teachers as well. But I think seeing that people are learning languages or people are doing these things that they've always wanted to be doing, but they never had the time, that can feel a bit pressurizing as well, that we have to be always maximizing everything and actually listening to yourself and thinking, actually, I'm just a bit tired and that's okay. Or I don't have to be learning a language. I don't have to be writing a book or making that YouTube channel. What I need to do right now is actually just get through it. And that's got to be enough. And it's about sort of surviving it and coming out the other end intact as much as possible, rather than everything having to be an opportunity. And like I said, there are opportunities to still keep going in recovery during this time, even though it's in a slightly different way. But it's not pressure. I think that's the main point, not a pressure that you have to get better by the end of it, or that you have to have achieved loads and smashed all your goals by the end of it.
For sure, definitely. There is such a hailstorm, particularly online right now, of that kind of pressure. And at times it can feel quite accusatory, you know, that people are not only putting up what they're doing, but in doing so, there's a sort of question mark of what are you doing?
Yeah.
All these people that are just sat there scrolling through their Facebook, seeing how busy everyone else is, even though realistically someone might have done like a TikTok that day that maybe took them 10 minutes to film. And then although it's getting loads of views, they're just sitting around on social media on the other side of it.
Yeah, I think it's around sort of what do you think is valuable. And actually, sometimes it's valuable to take stock and not do very much in particular. I've been seeing a tweet going around which says something like, if you didn't smash your goals or do that project that you always wanted to do during lockdown, it's not because you didn't have the time, it's because you weren't disciplined. I thought it wasn't because I was really struggling with money, or it wasn't because I was really anxious all the time because of the pandemic. It just really writes off all the other things you might be struggling with. And so many people don't have the luxury of living in really nice houses with facilities, with outside space to do exercise or technology to use. You know, I think that a lot of it is quite loaded with privilege, and that's not really spoken about very much, because the people who can learn their instruments or do Zoom lessons in whatever tend to have the money to be able to do that. And a lot of people have lost their jobs. Or, you know, for me as a yoga teacher that's self-employed, I thought for a moment that everything was going to completely collapse and that I would have no income at all. But luckily, we happened to be able to get everything up online. But if that hadn't have happened, or the company didn't want to do things online, that could easily be me who's not able to participate in any of these things. We have to remember that it is quite a privilege to feel well enough, even in terms of mental health, to feel well enough to do enjoyable things during this time, or to be bettering yourself.
Right, absolutely. And that tweet that you mentioned there, I can't remember the person, but it was a American business person that put it out. And so that very much confirms what you're saying about the privilege that he's in a position in his career where he has the resources to fall back on in order for this to be free time. And then the other side of that is people are saying it's not a holiday. You know, that's what we think about when we think about free time, not global pandemic.
At the beach.
And then I'm aware that something you've been keeping a close eye on as well is the government's approach to this and the kind of the media coverage politically as well.
Yeah, I think I'm very politically minded because I've done quite a lot of campaigning directly with politicians, and especially around the 2015 general election, I did a big campaign with Mind, the mental health charity, around you know, what do we ask of our politicians in terms of what they can do for mental health, which the answer is we can ask them to do a lot more than they do. And I think that has led me to always be really involved in what's going on politically. And I'm always reading the news, and my app on my phone tells me that I've been reading the news for 4 or 5 hours a day or something. And I think maybe I should cut it down a little bit. But I also want to feel really involved. And I know it doesn't make any difference, me feeling involved, but in a situation where there is not much control on things that we would normally do in day-to-day life, somehow for me, like keeping an eye on it and feeling involved and having my own sense of having a stake in it, even if I'm not doing as much as I would like, of enact political change. I'm not leading the revolution or anything, but still knowing what's going on. I'm involved in society when I'm actually shut indoors. And I've been quite frustrated, really, about the whole response. Not in that I think everything has been bad. I just think that seeing how the government was so able to readily pour money into society, into the NHS, into the economy, when there was a threat of something for our physical health, I think that it's in some ways quite insulting to people who've been really, really struggling for a very long time with the very things that we're all struggling with now. So people with disabilities know what it's like to not be able to go to work, know what it's like to not have the financial means to get by, know what it's like to not be able to participate in things and to be locked down in the house and not be able to go out. But where has the support been for those people who've not been able to work for years because of a risk to their health? Is the level, is the, you know, hundreds of billions of support? And I'm really not saying that shouldn't have been given. It's really just frustrated me. And some of the narrative around giving people the support they need, I totally agree. There are so many ways in which so many people have not been getting the support that they need for such a long time. And that's always been called out as, I don't know, unrealistic or a luxury for years and years. And this idea of the people who need it most, that really frustrates me, because need is need. And if you need something, you need it. And if it's something the state should provide, they should provide it. This hierarchy of need plays into it as well, which I find really frustrating.
Which is quite opposite as well to what the NHS stands for, that it should be there for the healthcare needs of every person, not there be any kind of floor limit of how ill you need to be before you get the help. And yet so often, particularly with mental health, that's the way it goes, that there's such limited capacity and resources at times that you have to be really struggling to get the urgent support you may need.
Yeah, it's not a direct comparison, and maybe I'm not expressing it in the most articulate way, but I think that now there is financial support and there is government support for people because they can't do their work because there's a threat to health. In my life, there have been many times when I haven't been able to do work, haven't been able to sustain myself because of a threat to my health, where there was absolutely no support. And actually now I'm eligible for all kinds of schemes that would have been great when I was actually too unwell to work because of being so unwell mentally. And not that I'm ungrateful for it now, but it would have been nice at a time when I needed it and people have been living with great need that hasn't been understood or hasn't been met at all. I think that it sometimes plays out in the press briefings a little bit, where mental health comes up actually quite a bit. And I feel that there's a sense that politicians think that they need to be talking about it. And they know this is the thing that we need to talk about, but they don't really know how to talk about it with the same confidence as they do about physical health problems. And there was a lot of talk around the NHS still being open for business. And there were several press conferences where they were saying, you know, you must go and get support if you have an urgent medical need, like heart attack, like a stroke, like a suspected cancer. That was it. And that happened sort of time after time. And then there had to be sort of separate questions about, so what about mental health? And people don't realise that a psychiatric emergency is a medical emergency. And there isn't really a differentiation, and you should be going to A&E. But actually right now, thinking about what is the risk to people's lives, what are those excess deaths potentially going to be if people don't get support? Well, for men of my age, it's going to be suicide. It's much more likely. And I don't know why it's not higher up of the pack, alongside things like missed cancers, alongside things like your cardiac arrests or sepsis and things that aren't showing up in A&E.
Right.
I wish that politicians were shouting about that rather than having to be asked about that.
And I do wonder as well how much this could be from stigma, that not only do a lot of politicians not know how to speak about mental health in the same way they talk about physical health, but also they may just not want to, or they may still feel it's a taboo subject. And so whilst on one hand, the increased pressure to talk about it is really great, and to be honest, at times I've been really pleasantly surprised with the coverage of the mental health impact. That's also, as you say, got to be met with the support.
Yeah, absolutely. There was one example in a press conference recently, I think, where it might have been a question from the member of the public to the Prime Minister about what should people do when they're feeling suicidal. I think that actually one of the main parts of his answer was that there are helplines that you can call if you need support. And I thought, well, we see that so much in mental health services that should be looking after people and holding the risk themselves, where they say, oh, and call the Samaritans if you need help. And it's effectively the Prime Minister saying, well, you need to go to a charity, when the Prime Minister should be able to say, these are the mental health services available in the NHS that you can access and should be accessing right now. And this is the care and support that you should be getting through the state, not through, oh, well, you know, if you're feeling that bad, call a phone line. That's not the route of care within the NHS. And it should be something that's accommodated by the NHS as much as a heart attack.
Right, absolutely. That's such a good point, because particularly right now with COVID-19, you could never imagine him saying that in one of those cases.
Exactly. You wouldn't try a charity for a ventilator, would you? I mean, charities can be extremely helpful with feeling suicidal and with mental health problems, for sure. But it's not that you should have to go to a charity. There should be something else.
Right. It should be additional support rather than the support.
Yeah. And I think that that's something that worries me in one sense, that the charity sector has to pick up so much in terms of mental health care and support in this country and society. And on the other hand, it's something that's really wonderful about the UK, I think, that we have such a strong charity sector, and there are some fantastic charities doing amazing work. But I've sort of seen that from both sides, really. And one thing that I'm just becoming involved with is there's a £5 million pot of money given by the Department for Health and Social Care for urgent responses to coronavirus in the community in relation to mental health. So these panels that I'll be sitting on will be working out which projects in the community get the funding to respond to how coronavirus is impacting mental health. And I think that from what I've looked at so far, it is actually really impressive how much small organisations do with such little money, because they're so used to that. They're so used to having to scrape around the edges and actually really go for maximum impact. And a lot of it is done on goodwill. A lot of it is done through volunteering and through people not seeking to make any money out of it at all for themselves. And that's really, really wonderful. But part of me always will wish that that wasn't necessary. It shouldn't be that these services are extra. They should be core, because I know from my work with the NHS around eating disorders that we write the most wonderful guidelines, but whether they actually happen is a completely different matter. You can have the most wonderful package of care designed for people with eating disorders, but if the services aren't resourced, and it always really comes back to resource. Politically, I think it's a massive oversight, because it only stores up more expensive problems for the future. And I think that's the definition of a false economy.
For sure, that's a great point. And it's something that we've discussed a lot on the show recently, that it's certainly my belief that the pandemic will impact every single person's mental health. Luckily, it won't impact everyone's physical health. And so in many ways, you could argue that the importance of mentioning mental health in every briefing, if not most of them, is quite obvious, because that's affecting everyone. It's not just me saying that. The statistics that are coming through are starting to back it up. Like, we spoke to another guest from Rethink Mental Illness, and they're finding that 80% of people have experienced worse mental health during this time.
Yeah.
Of the remaining 20%, their mental health has changed, but for many of them, it's got better. But ultimately, everybody's mental health is being impacted in one way or other.
Mental health, for me, doesn't exist in a vacuum, and it's very rooted, or at least affected by the society that we live in and all the systems around us. And our contact with other people is fundamental to our mental health. And so, because life has changed so much in these fundamental ways, not being able to see other people, not being able to go to social spaces or activities that we would normally do, that, of course, is going to affect everybody's mental health in positive and negative ways. That's absolutely right to say that it will affect everybody's mental health, because mental health is affected by the way that you live your life day to day. So, of course, it's going to be impacted. And it would be lovely to have it more at the forefront. And certainly, you know, it's great that there's a £5 million package for charities to apply for funding to try and address that, the needs that will arise because of coronavirus. But I don't know if £5 million is enough.
Yeah, indeed. And if, like you, people are trying to navigate the news, and maybe it's frustrating them, maybe it's too stressful and they're not watching it as much, what kind of advice would you give on keeping up to date, but also not letting the news itself impact your mental health?
If you're like me, and you want to read it and you don't think it has negative impact on your mental health, then read it. I don't think there should be any shame in it. But I think working out when is it affecting your mental health is probably quite difficult and probably the key, because I read the news a lot and it affects me. It affects how I feel, but it doesn't affect my mental health overall, because the way in which I feel when I read it sometimes is really angry. Sometimes it's really interested. Sometimes I start feeling really passionate about it should be like this. And I find it connecting. So I find it connects me to my values, even though I'm not necessarily seeing my values represented. Although I am in loads of other ways, because you see so much community stuff. You see so many wonderful news stories actually at the moment, and so many examples of compassion in society and society coming together. So I find it connecting, even though it might connect me with my passion, which could seem a little bit negative sometimes, because I sometimes do go on a rant. So that for me is how I know that it's not impacting my mental health negatively, because I'm trying to find some meaning out of this really challenging situation, and staying up to date with what's going on helps me with that. But if it was tipping me into feeling really despairing and that I couldn't find any sources of hope in it, because if I looked at negative news or stuff that I didn't agree with, or responses from the government that I didn't agree with, and it made me feel hopeless rather than it making me feel, I wish it was like this, then it would probably push me down to feeling low in mood. Mm. Whereas now it doesn't necessarily make me feel low in mood. It just makes me think, oh, I wish it was different. So when it's engaging for me, that's great. When it's disengaging or dispiriting, and that I would be more worried about. And also it can make us really anxious, I think, not knowing what's going to happen. And partly that's why I'm always searching for clues and information of what's going to be the next policy and the next strategy and everything. Well, yeah, that's important to me. It's really not important to everyone, and that's fine. If you don't care about precise details about mental health policies, it doesn't make you a bad person or a bad campaigner, or you're not interested in mental health or anything. It just means that you don't need to know all the details, and that's fine. It's so important to just be okay with how you're relating to it.
I think that's really helpful, and it's interesting to hear how similar our approaches are. Because Danielle's nodding along in the background, because I'm doing the same thing. I'm trying to find whatever hints I can to what's next. But in doing so, that makes me feel a bit more in control and a lot safer as well, that I know what to expect. And then when I find predictions I have are correct, then there is a reassurance in that.
Mm.
So we will wrap up there then. Thanks so much for being on the show today.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me. And thanks for all that you do with your podcast.
Oh, thanks.